Lydia Ivanovna's.
Ah, that's it, that's it, Princess Myakaya began joyfully. They will ask Landau and see what he says.
Ask Landau? Why? Who is Landau?
What? You don't know Jules Landau, le fameux Jules Landau le clairvoyant?
He also is half-witted, but your sister's fate depends on him. See what comes of living in the provinces. You know nothing.
Landau, you see, was a commis in Paris and went to see a doctor. He fell asleep in the doctor's waiting room and, while asleep, began giving advice to all the patients, and very strange advice, too. Afterwards, Yuri Melodinsky's wife, the invalid's wife, you know, heard of that Landau and took him to see her husband. He is treating her husband. No good has been done, in my opinion, for he is still just as weak, but they believe in him and take him about with them. So they brought him to Russia. Here, everyone rushed at him, and he began treating everybody. He cured the Countess Betsubova, and she took such a fancy to him that she adopted him.
Adopted? How?
Simply adopted him. He is now no longer Landau, but Count Betsubov. However, that's not to the point.
But Lydia, I am very fond of her, but her head is not screwed on right,
naturally has rushed at this Landau, and now nothing is settled either by her or by Karenin without him.
So your sister's fate is now in the hands of this Landau, alias Count Betsubov.
Chapter 21. After an excellent dinner and a large quantity of brandy at Bartnyansky's, Oblonsky, only a little after the appointed time, entered the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's house.
"Who is with the Countess?
The Frenchman?"
Oblonsky asked the hall porter, noticing on the hall stand Karenin's overcoat, which he recognized, and a strange, absurd-looking paletot with clasps.
"Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin and Count Betsubov," the hall porter replied severely.
"The Princess Myakaya guessed correctly," thought Oblonsky as he ascended the stairs.
"Strange. But it would be just as well to make friends with her. She has tremendous influence. If she would say a word to Pomorsky, the job is done."
It was still quite light out of doors, but in the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's small drawing room the blinds were down and the lamp alight. At the round table beneath a lamp sat the Countess and Karenin, conversing in low tones. A short, lean man, with hips like a woman's, knock-kneed, very pale, handsome, with beautiful, shining eyes and long hair that hung over the collar of his frock coat, stood at the opposite end of the room, looking at the portraits on the wall. After greeting the hostess and Karenin, Oblonsky involuntarily glanced at the stranger once more.
"Monsieur Landau," the Countess addressed him with a softness and caution that struck Oblonsky, and she introduced them. Landau hurriedly looked round, approached smilingly, laid upon Oblonsky's outstretched hand his own moist and motionless one, went back, and continued looking at the portraits. The Countess and Karenin glanced at each other significantly.
"I am very pleased to see you, especially today," said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, pointing to a seat beside Karenin.
"I introduced him to you as Landau," she said softly, glancing at the Frenchman and then back at Oblonsky. "But really he is Count Betsubov, as you probably know. But he does not like that title."
"Yes, I have heard," replied Oblonsky. "They say he has completely cured the Countess Betsubov."
"She called on me today and was so pathetic," said the Countess, turning to Karenin. "This separation is dreadful for her. It is such a blow to her."
"Is he going, definitely?" inquired Karenin.
"Yes, he is going to Paris." "He heard a voice yesterday," said the Countess, with a look at Oblonsky.
"Ah, a voice," Oblonsky remarked,
feeling that he must be as careful as possible in this company, where something peculiar occurred, or was supposed to occur, to which he as yet lacked a clue. After a momentary pause, the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, as if coming to the important point, turned with a subtle smile to Oblonsky.
"I have known you a long time, and am very pleased to know you more intimately.
Les amis de nos amis sont nos amis.
But to be a friend, one must enter into the state of the friend's soul, and I fear you will not do so in relation to Alexei Alexandrovich. You understand what I am speaking about?" she said, lifting her beautiful, dreamy eyes.
"To some extent, Countess. I understand that Alexei Alexandrovich's position," said Oblonsky, not quite grasping what it was all about, and therefore wishing to keep to generalities.
"The change is not in his external position," Lydia Ivanovna said severely, as her enamoured eyes followed Karenin, who had risen and joined Landau. "His heart is changed. He has been given a new heart. And I fear that you may not have realized fully that change which has been accomplished within him."
"Well, broadly speaking, I can picture to myself the change. We have always been friendly, and now," Oblonsky said, answering her look with a tender gaze, while he considered with which of two ministers she was the more closely connected, so as to judge which of them he should ask her to influence on his behalf.
"The change that has taken place in him cannot weaken his love for his neighbour. On the contrary, that change must strengthen his love. But I fear you don't understand me. Won't you have some tea?" she said, indicating with her eyes the footman who was handing tea round on a tray.
"Not quite, Countess. Of course his misfortune..."
"Yes, a misfortune which has turned into a great blessing, because his heart became new and is filled with him," she said, glancing at Oblonsky with lovesick eyes.
"I think I might ask her to mention me to both," thought he.
"Oh, certainly, Countess," he said. "But I think such changes are so very intimate that nobody, not even the closest friend, cares to speak about them."
"On the contrary, we must speak, and so help one another."
"Oh, yes, of course, but there are such differences of conviction, and besides," said Oblonsky with a gentle smile,
"there cannot be any differences in what concerns the holy truth."
"Oh, no, of course not, but..."
And becoming embarrassed, Oblonsky stopped short. He realized that it was a question of religion.
"It seems to me he will fall asleep directly," said Karenin in a significant whisper, approaching Lydia Ivanovna.
Oblonsky turned. Landau was sitting by the window, leaning against the arm and back of an easy chair, with his head hanging down. Noticing the looks directed toward him, he smiled a childishly naive smile.
"Take no notice of him," said Lydia Ivanovna,
and with an agile movement she pushed forward a chair for Karenin.
"I have noticed," she began, when a footman entered with a note.
Lydia Ivanovna rapidly read the note, and, excusing herself with extreme rapidity, wrote and dispatched the answer and returned to the table.
"I have noticed," she continued her interrupted sentence, "that Muscovites, men especially, are most indifferent to religion."
"Oh, no, Countess. I think Muscovites have the reputation of being the most steadfast believers," replied Oblonsky.
"But as far as I know, you, unfortunately, are one of the indifferent," Karenin remarked to him with a weary smile.
"How can one be indifferent?" said Lydia Ivanovna.
"I am, in this respect, not precisely indifferent, but rather expectant," said Oblonsky, with his most mollifying smile. "I do not think that, for me, the time for those questions has yet come."
Karenin and Lydia Ivanovna exchanged looks.
"We never know whether our time has come or not," Karenin said sternly. "We should not consider whether we are ready or not.
Grace is not influenced by human calculations. Sometimes it does not descend on those who seek it, but descends on the unprepared, as on Saul.
No, not yet, I think, said Lydia Ivanovna, who was watching the Frenchman's movements.
Landau rose and came up to them.
You will allow me to listen? He asked.
Oh, yes, I did not wish to disturb you, said Lydia, looking tenderly at him. Sit down beside us.
Only one must not shut one's eyes so as to deprive oneself of light, Karenin continued.
Oh, if you only knew the happiness we experience, feeling his continual presence in our souls, cried the Countess Lydia Ivanovna with a beatific smile.
But one may sometimes feel incapable of ascending to such heights, remarked Oblonsky,
conscious that he was not quite honest in acknowledging the existence of religious heights, yet not venturing to confess his scepticism in the presence of one who, by a single word to Pomorsky, might secure him the desired post.
You mean to say he is prevented by sin? Said Lydia Ivanovna.
But that is a false view.
Sin does not exist for a believer.
Sin has already been atoned for.
Excuse me, she added, glancing at the footman, who entered with another note. She read it and answered by word of mouth.
Tell him tomorrow at the Grand Duchess's.
For those who believe, there is no sin, she went on.
Yes, but faith without works is dead, said Oblonsky, recalling that sentence from the catechism, and only by a smile maintaining his independence.
There it is, from the Epistle of St. James, said Karenin, addressing Lydia Ivanovna in a somewhat reproachful tone. Evidently this was a point they had discussed more than once. How much harm has been done by a false interpretation of that passage? Nothing turns so many from the faith as that interpretation. I have no works, and therefore cannot have faith. Yet it is not so said anywhere. Just the contrary is said.
To labour for God with works to save one's soul by fasting, said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna with fastidious disdain. Those are the barbarous opinions of our monks, yet it is not so said anywhere. It is much simpler and easier, she added, looking at Oblonsky with the same encouraging smile with which at court she encouraged young maids of honour who were confused by their new surroundings.
We are saved by Christ, who suffered for us. We are saved by faith. Karenin chimed in, showing his approval of her remark by a look.
Vous comprenez l'anglais? Asked Lydia Ivanovna,
and having received an affirmative answer, she rose and began looking among the books on a shelf.
I want to read Safe and Happy or Under the Wing, she said with a questioning look at Karenin. And having found the book and sat down again, she opened it. It is quite short. It describes the way to acquire faith, and the joy, higher than anything else on earth, with which it fills the soul.
A believer cannot be unhappy because he is not alone. But you will see.
She was about to begin reading when the footman came in again.
Borodstina, say tomorrow at 2.
Yes, she went on, keeping her finger in the book to mark the place, and sighed, looking with her beautiful, dreamy eyes straight before her. This is how true faith acts. You know Maria Sanina? You have heard of her misfortune?
She lost her only child.
She was in despair.
Well? And what happened?
She found this friend. And now she thanks God for her child's death.
That is the happiness faith gives.
Oh, yes, it is very, began Oblonsky, glad that she was going to read and give him time to get his ideas together.
No, evidently it will be better not to ask for anything tonight, he reflected. Only let me get away from here without making a mess of things.
"It will be dull for you," said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, turning to Landau, "as you don't understand English. But it is quite short."
"Oh, I shall understand," replied Landau with the same smile, and closed his eyes.
Karenin and Lydia Ivanovna exchanged significant looks, and the reading began.
Chapter 22. Oblonsky felt completely puzzled by the strange and novel language he was listening to. Generally, the complications of Petersburg life had an exhilarating effect on him, lifting him out of the Moscow stagnation. But he liked and understood complications in spheres congenial and familiar to him. In these strange surroundings, he felt puzzled and dazed and could not take it all in. Listening to the Countess Lydia Ivanovna and feeling the fine eyes, naive or roguish, he did not know which, of Landau fixed upon him, Oblonsky began to be conscious of a peculiar sort of heaviness in his head. The most varied ideas were mixed up in his mind. "Maria Sanina is glad that her child is dead. I should like to have a smoke. To be saved, one need only have faith. The monks don't know how to do it, but the Countess Lydia Ivanovna knows. And what is so heavy in my head? Is it the brandy, or is it because all this is so very strange? All the same, I think I have not done anything to shock them up till now. But still, it won't do to ask her help now. I have heard that they make one pray. Supposing they make me pray? That would be too stupid. And what nonsense she is reading, but her enunciation is good. Landau Betsubov. Why is he Betsubov?" Suddenly, Oblonsky felt his nether jaw dropping irresistibly for a yawn. He smoothed his whiskers to hide the yawn and gave himself a shake. But then he felt himself falling asleep and nearly snored. He roused himself just when the Countess Lydia Ivanovna uttered the words, "He is asleep." Oblonsky awoke in a fright, feeling guilty and detected. But he was immediately comforted by noticing that the words, "he is asleep," did not apply to him, but to Landau. The Frenchman had fallen asleep just as Oblonsky had done. But whereas Oblonsky's sleep would, he imagined, have offended them, he did not really even think this, for everything seemed so strange, Landau's sleep delighted them extremely, especially Lydia Ivanovna.
"Mon ami," said she, carefully holding the folds of her silk dress to prevent its rustling, and in her excitement calling Karenin not Alexei Alexandrovich, but "mon ami, donnez-lui la main. Vous voyez?"
"Hush," she said to the footman, who came in again. "I am not receiving."
The Frenchman slept, or pretended to sleep, leaning his head against the back of the chair, and his moist hand, lying on his knee, moved feebly, as if catching something. Karenin rose, and though he tried to be cautious, he caught against the table. He went up to the Frenchman and placed his hand in his. Oblonsky also rose, and opening his eyes wide to wake himself up in case he was asleep, looked first at one and then at the other. It was all quite real, and Oblonsky felt his head getting worse and worse.
"Que la personne qui est arrivée la dernière, celle qui demande, quelle sorte? Quelle sorte?"
the Frenchman said, without opening his eyes.
"Vous m'excuserez, mais vous voyez? Revenez vers 10 heures, encore mieux, demain."
"Quelle sorte?"
repeated the Frenchman impatiently.
"C'est moi, n'est-ce pas?"
And having received an answer in the affirmative, Oblonsky, forgetting the request he had wanted to make to Lydia Ivanovna, forgetting his sister's affairs, and with the one desire to get away from there as quickly as possible, went out on tiptoe and ran out into the street as from an infected house. After which he talked and joked for a long time with an izvozchik, trying to regain his senses as soon as possible. At the French Theatre, where he arrived in time for the last act, and afterwards at the Tatar restaurant, where he had some champagne, Oblonsky was able to some extent to breathe again in an atmosphere congenial to him.
but nevertheless he was not at all himself that evening. When he returned to Pyotr Oblonsky's house where he was staying, he found a note from Betsy. She wrote that she greatly wished to finish the conversation they had begun and asked him to call next day. Scarcely had he finished reading the note and made a wry face over it, when he heard downstairs the heavy steps of men carrying something heavy. He went down to see what it was. It was Pyotr Oblonsky, grown young again. He was so drunk that he could not get up the stairs, but on seeing Oblonsky he ordered the men to put him on his feet, and clinging to Stepan he went with him to his room, began relating how he had spent the evening, and fell asleep there. Oblonsky was in low spirits, a thing that rarely happened to him, and could not fall asleep for a long time. Everything he recalled was nauseous, but most repulsive of all, like something shameful, was the memory of the evening at Lydia Ivanovna's. Next day he received from Karenin a definite refusal to divorce Anna, and understood that this decision was based on what the Frenchman had said the evening before in his real or pretended sleep. Chapter 23. Before any definite step can be taken in a household, there must be either complete division or loving accord between husband and wife. When their relations are indefinite, it is impossible for them to make any move. Many families continue for years in their old ruts, hated by both husband and wife, merely because there is neither complete discord nor harmony. Both for Vronsky and for Anna, life in Moscow in the heat and dust, when the sun no longer shone as in spring but burned as in summer, when all the trees on the boulevards had long been in leaf and the leaves were already covered with dust, was intolerable. Nevertheless, they did not move to Vozvizenskoye, as they had long ago decided to do, but stayed in Moscow, which had become obnoxious to them both, because of late there had not been harmony between them. The irritation which divided them had no tangible cause, and all attempts at an explanation not only failed to clear it away, but increased it. It was an inner irritation, caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his by regret that for her sake he had placed himself in a distressing situation which she, instead of trying to alleviate, made still harder. Neither of them spoke of the cause of their irritation, but each thought the other in the wrong, and at every opportunity tried to prove that this was so. For her, he, with all his habits, thoughts, wishes, mental and physical faculties, the whole of his nature, consisted of one thing only, love for women, and this love she felt ought to be wholly concentrated on her alone. This love was diminishing, therefore, in her judgment, part of his love must have been transferred to other women, or to one other woman. She was jealous not of any one woman, but of the diminution of his love. Not having as yet an object for her jealousy, she sought one. At the slightest hint she transferred her jealousy from one object to another. Now she was jealous of the coarse women with whom, through his bachelor connections, he might so easily have intercourse. Now of the society women whom he might meet. Now of some imaginary girl whom he might marry after repudiating her. This last jealousy tormented her more than anything else, especially since, in an expansive moment, he had carelessly told her that his mother understood him so little that she had tried to persuade him to marry the young Princess Sorokina. And being jealous, Anna was indignant with him and constantly sought reasons to justify her indignation. She blamed him for everything that was hard in her situation. The torture of expectation, living betwixt heaven and earth, which she endured there in Moscow, Karenin's dilatoriness and indecision, her loneliness, she attributed all to him. If he loved her, he would fully understand the difficulty of her situation and would deliver her from it. That they were living in Moscow instead of in the country was also his fault. He could not live buried in the country as she desired. He needed society, and so he had placed her in this terrible position, the misery of which he would not understand.
and it was likewise his fault that she was forever parted from her son. Even the rare moments of tenderness which occurred between them did not pacify her. In his tenderness she now saw a tinge of calm assurance which had not been there before, and irritated her. It was growing dusk. Anna, all alone, awaiting his return from a bachelor dinner party, paced up and down his study, which was the room in which the street noises were least audible, recalling in detail every word of their yesterday's quarrel. Passing ever backwards from the memorably offensive words of the quarrel to their cause, she at last got back to the beginning of their conversation. For a long time she could not believe that the dispute had begun from a perfectly inoffensive conversation about a matter that did not touch the hearts of either. Yet it was so. It had all begun by his laughing at high schools for girls, which he considered unnecessary, and she defended. He spoke disrespectfully of the education of women in general, and said that Hannah, her little English protégé, did not at all need to know physics. This provoked Anna. She saw in it a contemptuous allusion to her own knowledge, and she invented and uttered a phrase in retaliation which should revenge the pain he had caused her. "I don't expect you to understand me and my feelings as an affectionate man would, but I did expect ordinary delicacy," she said. And he really had flushed with vexation and had said something disagreeable. She did not remember her reply to it, but remembered that in answer he had said with obvious intent to hurt her, too, "I can take no interest in your partiality for that little girl, because I can see that it is unnatural." The cruelty with which she annihilated the world which she had so painfully constructed for herself to be able to endure her hard life, the injustice of his accusation that she was dissembling and unnatural, roused her indignation. "I am very sorry that only what is coarse and material is comprehensible and natural to you," she retorted, and left the room. When he came to her in the evening, they did not refer to the quarrel, but both felt that it was only smoothed over, not settled. Today he had been away from home all day, and she had felt so lonely, and it was so painful to feel herself at discord with him, that she wished to forget it all, to forgive and make it up with him. Wishing even to blame herself and to justify him, she said to herself, "I am to blame. I am irritable and unreasonably jealous. I will make it up with him, and we will go back to the country. There I shall be calmer." "Unnatural!" She suddenly remembered the word that had hurt her most, though it was not so much the word as his intention to pain her. "I know what he wanted to say. He wanted to say that it is unnatural not to love one's own daughter and yet to love another's child. What does he know of love for children? Of my love for Seretse, whom I have given up for his sake, and that desire to hurt me? No, he must be in love with some other woman. It can't be anything else." Then, realizing that in her attempt to quiet herself she had again completed the circle she had already gone round so often, and had returned to her former cause of irritation, she was horror-struck at herself. "Is it possible that I can't? Is it possible that I can't take it on myself?" she wondered, and began again from the beginning. "He is truthful. He is honest. He loves me, I love him. In a few days I shall get my divorce. What more do I need?" "I need calm and confidence, and I will take the blame on myself. Yes, now, as soon as he comes back, I will tell him I was to blame, though in fact I was not, and we will go away." And not to continue thinking, and not to yield to irritation, she rang and ordered her trunks to be brought, to pack their things for the country. At 10 o'clock, Vronsky returned. Chapter 24.
"Well, have you had a good time?" she asked, coming out to meet him with a meek and repentant look on her face.
"Just as usual," he answered, perceiving at a glance that she was in one of her pleasant moods. He was already accustomed to these transitions, and today was specially glad, because he himself was in the best of spirits.
"What do I see?"
"Ah, that's right," he said, pointing to the trunks in the anteroom.
"Yes, we must go away. I went for a drive, and it was so lovely that I longed to be in the country. There isn't anything to keep you, is there?"
"It is my only wish. I'll come in a moment, and we'll have a talk. I will only go and change. Order tea."
And he went to his room. There was something offensive in his saying, "Ah, that's right," as one speaks to a child when it stops being capricious. And still more offensive was the contrast between her guilty tone and his self-confident one. For a moment she felt a desire to fight, rising within her, but with an effort she mastered it and met him with her former cheerfulness. When he returned, she told him, partly repeating words she had prepared, how she had spent the day and her plans for the move to the country.
"Do you know, it came to me almost like an inspiration," said she. "Why must we wait here for the divorce? Won't it do just as well in the country? I can't wait any longer. I don't want to hope. I don't want to hear anything about the divorce. I have made up my mind that it shall not influence my life any more. Do you agree?"
"Oh, yes," he answered, looking uneasily at her excited face.
"Well, and what have you been doing? Who was there?" she asked after a pause.
Vronsky named the guests. "The dinner was capital. The boat races and everything quite nice. But in Moscow they can't get on without doing something ridiculous. Some sort of a lady turned up, the Queen of Sweden's swimming instructress, and displayed her art."
"What?
She swam?" asked Anna, with a frown.
"Yes, in some sort of red costume de natation. A hideous old creature."
"Well then, when are we to be off?"
"What an absurd fancy."
"And did she swim in some particular way?" asked Anna, without answering his question.
"Well, nothing particular at all. I said it was awfully absurd."
"Well, when do you think of going?"
Anna shook her head, as though driving away an unpleasant thought.
"When are we going? Why, the sooner the better. We can't get ready by tomorrow, but the day after?"
"Yes. No, wait a bit. The day after tomorrow is Sunday, and I must go and see Maman," said Vronsky, and became confused, because as soon as he had mentioned his mother, he felt an intent and suspicious gaze fixed upon him. His embarrassment confirmed her suspicions. She flushed and moved away from him. It was no longer the Queen of Sweden's instructress, but the Princess Sorokina, who lived in the country near Moscow with the Countess Vronskaya, who presented herself to Anna's imagination.
"You could go there tomorrow," she said.
"No, I tell you. The things about which I have to go, to fetch a power of attorney and some money, will not have arrived by tomorrow," he replied.
"If that's so, then we won't go at all."
"But why not?"
"I won't go any later, Monday or not at all."
"Why is that?" said Vronsky, as if in surprise.
"Well, there's no sense in that."
"You see no sense in it because you don't care at all about me. You don't want to understand what my life is. The one person I was interested in here was Hannah. You say that is all pretense. You said yesterday that I don't love my daughter, but pretend to love that English girl, and that it is unnatural. I should like to know what sort of life can be natural for me here."
For a moment she recollected herself and was horrified at having broken her resolution. Yet, though she knew she was ruining her cause, she could not restrain herself, could not forbear pointing out to him how wrong he was, and could not submit to him.
"I never said that. I only said that I do not sympathize with that sudden affection."
"Why do you, who boast of your truthfulness, not speak the truth?"
"I never boast and never tell untruths," he said softly, restraining his rising anger. "It is a great pity if you don't respect—"
"Respect was invented to fill the empty place where love ought to be. But if you no longer love me, it would be better and more honourable to say so."
"Dear me, this is becoming unbearable," exclaimed Vronsky, rising from his chair. And standing before her, he slowly brought out,
Why are you testing my patience?
He looked as if he could have said much more, but restrained himself.
It has its limits.
What do you mean by that? She cried, glancing with terror at the definite expression of hatred on his whole face, and especially in the cruel, menacing eyes.
I mean to say,
he began, but stopped.
I must ask what you want of me.
What can I want? I can only want you not to abandon me, as you are thinking of doing, she said, having understood all that he had left unsaid.
But I don't want that. That is secondary. What I want is love, and it is lacking. Therefore, all is finished.
She moved toward the door.
Stop. Stop! Said Vronsky, his brow still knit, but holding her back by the hand. What is the matter? I said we must put off our departure for 3 days, and you replied that I lie and am not an honourable man.
Yes.
And I repeat that a man who reproaches me because he has given up everything for my sake, said she, recalling the words of a still earlier quarrel, is worse than a dishonourable man. He is a heartless man. No! There are limits to one's endurance, he exclaimed, and quickly let go her hand.
He hates me, that is clear, thought she, and silently, without looking round and with faltering steps, she left the room. He loves another woman, that is clearer still, she said to herself as she entered her own room. I want love, and it is lacking, so everything is finished, she repeated her own words, and it must be finished. But how? She asked herself, and sat down in the armchair before the looking-glass. Thoughts of where she would now go, to the aunt who had brought her up, to Dolly, or simply abroad by herself, of what he was now doing alone in the study, of whether this quarrel was final or whether a reconciliation was still possible, of what all her former Petersburg acquaintances would say of her now, how Karenin would regard it, and many other thoughts about what would happen now after the rupture passed through her mind. But she did not give herself up entirely to these thoughts. In her soul there was another vague idea which alone interested her, but of which she could not get hold. Again remembering Karenin, she also remembered her illness after her confinement and the feeling that never left her at that time. She remembered her words, "Why did I not die?" and her feelings then. And suddenly she understood what was in her soul. Yes, that was the thought which would solve everything. Yes, to die. Alexei Alexandrovich's shame and disgrace, and Seretse's and my own terrible shame, all will be saved by my death. If I die, he too will repent, will pity me, will love me, and will suffer on my account. With a fixed smile of self-pity on her lips, she sat in the chair, taking off and putting on the rings on her left hand, and vividly picturing to herself from various points of view his feelings after she was dead. Sounds of approaching steps, his steps, distracted her thoughts. Pretending to be putting away her rings, she did not even turn round. He came up to her, and taking her hand, said softly,
Anna, let us go the day after tomorrow if you wish it. I will agree to anything.
She remained silent.
What is it?
He asked.
You know yourself, said she.
And at the same moment, unable to restrain herself any longer, she burst into tears.
Abandon me. Abandon me,
she murmured between her sobs.
I will go away tomorrow. I will do more. What am I? A depraved woman, a stone round your neck. I don't wish to torment you. I don't. I will set you free. You don't love me. You love someone else.
Vronsky implored her to be calm and assured her that there was not an atom of foundation for her jealousy, that he never had ceased and never would cease to love her, that he loved her more than ever.
"Anna, why torture yourself and me like this?" he said, kissing her hands.
His face now wore a tender expression, and she thought she detected in his voice the sound of tears and their moisture on her hand. And instantly her despairing jealousy changed into desperate, passionate tenderness. She embraced him and covered his head, his neck, and his hands with kisses. Chapter 25. Feeling that they were entirely reconciled, next morning Anna began actively to make preparations for their move. Though it was not settled whether they would go on the Monday or on the Tuesday, as each the night before had yielded to the other's wish, Anna made all ready for their start, feeling now quite indifferent whether they went a day sooner or later. She stood in her room before an open trunk, sorting clothes, when he came in earlier than usual and ready dressed.
"I will go to Maman at once. She can send me the money through Egorov, and I shall be ready to go tomorrow," said he.
Good as the mood she was in might be, the reference to the move to the country pricked her. "Oh no, I shall not be ready myself," she said, and immediately thought, "So it was possible to arrange things as I wished."
"No, do as you wish to. Go to the dining room. I will come directly. I will only sort out these things that are not wanted," she said, placing some more articles on the heap of old clothes already piled up on Anushka's arms. Vronsky was eating his beefsteak when she entered the dining room. "You would hardly believe how disgusting these rooms have become to me," she said, sitting down to her coffee beside him. "There is nothing worse than these furnished apartments. They are expressionless and soulless. This clock, the curtains, and above all, the wallpapers are a nightmare. I think of Vozvizhenskoy as of a promised land." "You are not sending off the horses yet?"
"No, they will follow us. Are you driving out anywhere?"
"I wanted to go to the Wilsons to take her address." "So it is decided that we go tomorrow?" she said in a cheerful voice. But suddenly her face changed.
Vronsky's valet came in to fetch a receipt for a telegram from Petersburg. There was nothing odd in his receiving a telegram, but as if wishing to hide something from her, he told the man that the receipt was in his study and hastily turned to her, saying,
"I shall certainly get everything ready tomorrow."
"From whom was the telegram?" she asked, not listening to him.
"From Stiva,"
he replied reluctantly.
"Why didn't you show it me?
What secret can Stiva have from me?"
Vronsky called back the valet and told him to bring the telegram.
"I did not wish to show it you because Stiva has a passion for telegraphing. Oh, what is the use of telegraphing when nothing has been settled?"
"About the divorce?"
"Yes, but he wires, 'could get no answer, promises a decisive answer soon. But read it yourself.'"
Anna took the telegram with trembling hands and saw exactly what Vronsky had said, but at the end were added the words, "Little hope, but I'll do everything possible and impossible."
"I said yesterday that it is all the same to me when I get the divorce, or even whether I get it at all," she said, flushing. "There was no need at all to conceal it from me."
And she thought, "In the same way he may hide, and is hiding from me, his correspondence with women."
"Oh, Yashvin wanted to come this morning with Voitov," said Vronsky. "It seems he has won from Pevtsov all and even more than Pevtsov can pay, about 60,000 rubles.
"But why do you imagine," said she, irritated at his intimating to her so obviously by this change of subject that he saw she was losing her temper, "that this news interests me so much that it is necessary to conceal it? I said that I don't want to think about it, and I wish that you were as little interested in it as I am."
"It interests me because I like definiteness," he replied.
"Definiteness depends not on forms, but on love," she said, growing more and more irritated, not at his words, but at the tone of cool tranquillity with which he spoke.
"Why do you want it?"
Oh, God, again about love, he thought, with a wry face.
Don't you know why? For your own sake, and for that of the children we may have, said he.
We shan't have any.
That's a great pity, he said.
You want it for the children, but you don't think of me, she pursued, quite forgetting or not hearing that he said, for your own sake and for the children.
The possibility of having children had long been a subject of dispute, and it irritated her. She explained his desire to have children as showing that he did not value her beauty.
Oh, I said, for your sake. Most of all, for your sake, he repeated, his face contorted as with pain. Because I am convinced that a great deal of your irritability is due to our indefinite position.
Yes, there it is. Now he has stopped pretending, and all his cold hatred for me is apparent, she thought, not listening to his words, but gazing with horror at the cold and cruel judge who looked out of his eyes provokingly.
That is not the reason, she said, and I can't even understand how what you call my irritability can be caused by that. I am entirely in your power.
What indefiniteness of position is there? Quite the contrary.
I'm very sorry you don't wish to understand me, he interrupted, stubbornly intent on expressing his thought. The indefiniteness consists in your imagining that I am free.
You may be perfectly at rest on that matter, she rejoined, and turning away, she began to drink her coffee. She took her cup, sticking out her little finger, and raised it to her mouth. After a few sips, she glanced at him, and from the expression of his face clearly realized that her hand, her movement, and the sound made by her lips were repulsive to him.
It is perfectly indifferent to me what your mother thinks and whom she wishes to marry you to, she went on, putting down her cup with a trembling hand.
But we're not talking about that.
Yes, about that very thing.
And believe me, a heartless woman, be she old or young, your mother or a stranger, does not interest me, and I don't want to have anything to do with her.
Anna,
I beg you not to speak disrespectfully of my mother.
A woman whose heart has not divined wherein her son's happiness and honour lies has no heart.
I repeat my request that you should not speak disrespectfully of my mother, whom I respect, said he, raising his voice and looking sternly at her.
She did not reply. Looking intently at his face and hands, she remembered their reconciliation the day before, and his passionate caresses in all their details.
Just such caresses he has lavished and wants to lavish on other women, she thought.
You don't love your mother. It's all words, 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 she said, looking at him with hatred.
If that's so, we must decide.
And I have decided, she said,
and was about to go away. But just then Yashvin entered. Anna said, good morning, and stopped.
Why, when a storm was raging within her,
and she felt that she was at a turning point which might lead to terrible consequences, why she need at that moment dissemble before a stranger who sooner or later would know all about it, she did not know. But immediately calming the storm within her, she sat down again and began talking to the visitor.
Well, how are your affairs? Has the money been paid? She asked Yashvin.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I shall get it all. And on Wednesday I must go. And you? Asked Yashvin, looking at Vronsky with half-closed eyes and evidently divining that there had been a quarrel.
The day after tomorrow, I believe, replied Vronsky.
But you have been meaning to go for a long time past.
Yes, but now it's decided, said Anna, looking straight into Vronsky's eyes, with an expression that told him he must not think of the possibility of a reconciliation.
Is it possible you are not sorry for that unfortunate Pevtsov? She said, continuing her conversation with Yashvin.
I never asked myself, Anna Arkadyevna, whether I am sorry or not. You see, my whole fortune is here,
and he pointed to a side pocket,
and now I am a rich man. But I shall go to the club tonight, and shall perhaps leave it a beggar. You see, he who sits down to play against me wishes to leave me without a shirt, and I treat him the same.
So we struggle, and therein lies the pleasure.
But supposing you were married, how would your wife feel about it? Asked Anna.
Yashvin laughed.
I expect that's why I never married and never meant to.
How about Helsingfors? Said Vronsky, joining in the conversation, and he glanced at Anna, who had smiled. Meeting his look, her face suddenly assumed a coldly severe expression, as if to say, It is not forgotten. It is still the same.
Is it possible you were ever in love? She asked Yashvin.
Oh, heavens, how many times! But you see, some men find it possible to sit down to cards and yet to be able always to leave when the time comes for an assignation. Now, I can engage in lovemaking, but always so as not to be late for cards in the evening. That's how I manage.
No, I'm not asking about that, but about the real thing.
She was going to say Helsingfors, but did not want to repeat the word Vronsky had used. Voitov, who was buying a horse from Vronsky, arrived, and Anna rose and left the room. Before leaving the house, Vronsky came to her room. She wished to pretend to be looking for something on the table, but feeling ashamed of the pretense, looked straight into his face with a cold expression.
What do you want?
She asked in French.
Gambetta's certificate. I have sold him,
he replied, in a tone which said more clearly than words, I have no time for explanations, and they would lead to nothing.
I am not at all in the wrong toward her, he thought.
If she wants to punish herself, tant pis pour elle.
But as he was going out, he thought she said something, and suddenly his heart ached with pity for her.
What, Anna?
Nothing, she answered, in the same cold, quiet manner. If it's nothing, then tant pis, he thought, again chilled. Turning away, he went out. As he was going, he caught sight in a looking-glass of her pale face and trembling lips. He even wished to stop and say a comforting word to her, but his legs carried him out of the room before he had thought of anything to say. All that day he spent away from home, and when he returned late at night, the maid told him that Anna Arkadyevna had a headache and asked him not to go to her room. Chapter 26 Never before had they been at enmity for a whole day. This was the first time it had been so, and this was not even a quarrel. It was an evident acknowledgement of complete estrangement. How could he look at her as he had looked when he came into the room for the certificate? Look at her, see that her heart was torn by despair, and go out in silence with that calmly indifferent look. Not only had he cooled toward her, but he hated her because he loved another woman. That was clear. And recalling all the cruel words he had uttered, Anna invented other words, which he evidently had wished to say and could have said to her, and she grew more and more exasperated. "I do not hold you," he might have said. "You may go where you please. You probably did not wish to be divorced from your husband so that you could go back to him. Go back. If you need money, I will give you some. How many rubles do you want?" All the cruelest words that a coarse man could say, he, in her imagination, said to her, and she did not forgive him for them any more than if he had really said them. And was it not last night that he, an honourable and truthful man, swore he loved me? Have I not often before despaired needlessly? She said to herself immediately after. All that day, except when she went to the Wilsons, which took her about 2 hours, Anna passed in doubting whether all was over, or whether there was still hope of a reconciliation, and whether she ought to leave at once or to see him again. She waited for him all day, and in the evening, when she went to her room, having left word for him that she had a headache, she thought, "If he comes in spite of the maid's message, it means that he still loves me. If not, it means that all is over. And then I will decide what I am to do." At night she heard his carriage stop, heard him ring, heard his steps and his voice talking to the maid. He believed what he was told, did not want to learn more, and went to his room. So all was over.
and death, as the sole means of reviving love for herself in his heart, of punishing him, and of gaining the victory in that contest which an evil spirit in her heart was waging against him, presented itself clearly and vividly to her. Now it was all the same whether they went to Vozvizenskoy or not, whether she got a divorce or not. It was all useless. All she wanted was to punish him. When she poured out her usual dose of opium and thought that she need only drink the whole phial in order to die, it seemed to her so easy and simple that she again began thinking with pleasure of how he would suffer, repent, and love her memory when it was too late. She lay in bed with open eyes, looking at the stucco cornice under the ceiling by the light of a single burnt-down candle, and at the shadow of the screen which fell on it, and she vividly imagined what he would feel when she was no more, when she was for him nothing but a memory. "How could I say those cruel words to her?" he would say. "How could I leave the room without saying anything?" But now she is no more. She has gone from us forever. She is there. Suddenly the shadow of the screen began to move and spread over the whole of the cornice, the whole ceiling. Other shadows rushed toward it from another side. For an instant they rushed together. But then again they spread with renewed swiftness, flickered, and all was darkness. "Death," she thought. And such terror came upon her that it was long before she could realize where she was, and with trembling hand could find the matches to light another candle in the place of the one that had burnt down and gone out. "No. Anything, only to live. Why, I love him, and he loves me. All this has been, but will pass," she said, feeling that tears of joy at this return to life were running down her cheeks. And, to escape from her fears, she hastily went to him in his study. He was sleeping in the study, and was sound asleep. She came up, and holding the light above him, looked at him long. Now, when he was asleep, she loved him so that she could not restrain tears of tenderness while looking at him. But she knew that if he were to wake, he would look at her with a cold expression, conscious of his own integrity, and that before telling him of her love, she must prove to him that he was to blame toward her. Without waking him, she returned to her room, and after a second dose of opium toward morning, she fell into a heavy but troubled sleep, without ever ceasing to be conscious of herself. In the morning, a terrible nightmare, which had come to her several times even before her union with Vronsky, repeated itself and woke her. An old man with a tangled beard was leaning over some iron and doing something while muttering senseless words in French. And, as always in that nightmare, this was what made it terrible. She felt this peasant was paying no attention to her, but was doing something dreadful to her with the iron. And she awoke in a cold perspiration. When she got up, the previous day appeared in her memory as in a fog. There had been a quarrel. It was what had happened several times before. "I said I had a headache, and he did not come to see me. Tomorrow we shall leave. I must see him and get ready for the move," she thought. And hearing that he was in the study, she went to him. As she passed through the drawing-room, she heard a vehicle stop at the front door, and, looking out of the window, she saw a young girl in a lilac hat leaning out of the carriage window and giving an order to the footman who was ringing at the front door. After some talking in the hall, someone came upstairs, and she heard Vronsky's step outside the drawing-room. He was going quickly downstairs. Again Anna went to the window. There he was on the steps, without a hat, going down to the carriage. The young girl in the lilac hat handed him a parcel. Vronsky said something to her and smiled. The carriage rolled away. He ran rapidly upstairs again. The fog that had obscured everything within her was suddenly dissipated. Yesterday's feelings wrung her aching heart with fresh pain. She could not now understand how she could have humiliated herself so as to remain a whole day with him in his house. She went to his study to announce to him her decision.